This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get an update on police body cams. Pilot projects are on the street in Bloomington Normal. Bloomington police are trained to create a narrative arc verbally on the recording.
In a sense, you're almost producing a movie when you arrive for a call for service, and you need to inform the viewer of what's going on.
Sergeant Clayton Arnold talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about the importance of context. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio to discuss a proposed citizen review board for the police department. They'll also answer questions about East Side development versus city core redevelopment. And GLT's Laura Kennedy talks with a member of the Friends of the Arts and a student artist about a fundraiser to help alleviate student debt. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 16th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The city of Bloomington may be moving toward a citizen-led police review board. During a committee of the whole meeting Monday evening, aldermen also discussed the city's 20-year comprehensive plan and its relation to a sewer oversizing project on the city's Far East Side. In the studio to talk about both issues is Mayor Terry Renner. Terry, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Awesome to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with the sewer oversizing project and whether it should be included in the FY18 budget. What direction did you sense from aldermen last night?
I think it was pretty clear that this was not supported by the majority, maybe nobody on the city council. I think there were a couple who still wanted a little more information. But this is inconsistent with our comprehensive plan that almost 8,000 people were involved in. We have, and I've been saying this as I've been running for mayor, is that we can't continue to sprawl to the east. We see unacceptable times, for example, in responses to 911 service. It's just very, very, very costly. So we are trying to be a more sustainable city for the future. And that's the policies that I'm pursuing. This would absolutely be inconsistent with that.
Some people, I think, in the community think this is about the $300,000. It's not really about the $300,000 in a $210 million budget.
Well, it's about the $300,000 in some ways. That's the smaller issue. I would like that $300,000 to be put into existing sewers and rather than hypothetically doing this for a development that, frankly, I don't think we would ever really want to include in the city of Bloomington. But there is that broader issue. You're absolutely right on that. It's far bigger than $300,000. It's what is Bloomington going to be over the next generation? How are we going to, if we're going to grow, you know, in a very sensible way, in a sustainable way, we sure, we don't want to do this. We don't want to encourage sprawl. And certainly new developments then, if they want to live out, 15 miles, fine. Then let them provide their own services. Don't expect the city of Bloomington taxpayers to foot the bill for this.
Some aldermen wanted to know what that $300,000 might buy. Do we have accurate figures on what it would get you in resurfacing or future sewer relining in the city's core?
Well, essentially, Jim Karch, our public works director, was going to get back to us on giving us some examples of what we could do. But certainly we could reline several miles of sewers with that $300,000.
And fix 100-year-old sewers.
Exactly.
Do you think aldermen or the majority of the aldermen grasp the underlying issues of encouraging sprawl here, or do they see this as a ward versus ward kind of thing?
Well, some were talking about this as a ward versus ward thing. I think the majority understand that this is really not about the Grove. And let's be clear, nobody who lives in the Grove would benefit from this.
Or be hurt by it.
Well, actually, in a way, they could. Like, if this was oversized and we incorporated areas to the north of them, they could be hurt by it because there'd even be more congestion. There's apparently fairly long waits during, what we call rush hour, on Ireland Grove and Towanda Barnes Road.
Basically, there are two country roads servicing that subdivision.
Exactly. And again, none of this was planned out. It's But at this point, the whole issue here is actually sprawl. It's not to pick on the Grove.
Sure, and the Grove is sort of getting kicked around a little bit here.
Yes.
Unfairly. Yes. It's not about the Grove subdivision. It's about future development around the Grove or essentially north of the Grove subdivision.
Absolutely. Thanks for pointing that out. So that's absolutely the case. It's a 500-foot issue. It's really not about the Grove.
And there's still room for home development in the boundaries of the current Grove subdivision as it exists.
As it exists. And there are other areas of infill. If people want, we've heard some people don't want to live in old historic homes. Okay, that's fine. There are plenty of options. If you really want to grow, there are areas south of Ireland Grove that are about 4 or 5 miles closer.
Sure. Well,
we won't have to build another fire station because of it. We don't have to run newer sewer lines out because of it. It's probably more sustainable, and it could probably pay for itself, which new growth should at least pay for itself. We shouldn't be taking money out of the pockets of people from our historic core or the west side or even the east side, current residents, to pay for development.
Do you think city staff, after this committee of the whole meeting last night, has a clearer direction now as it concerns these kinds of choices when it comes to the future budgets and future expenditures?
I think that point was made crystal clear. And actually, one of our strongest proponents of smart growth and smart development, Alderwoman Amelia Burgess, was not present last night. So, and she certainly would have added to the conversation. So I think it's very clear where the gravitational pull is at this point. And my guess is at the end of the day, this might even be supported by a 9-0 vote to take this out. Now, I could have line item vetoed this. And I did suggest that, but for a variety of reasons, partly because I didn't want it to seem like I was just picking on the Grove, but also to have a broader council discussion. And as you mentioned, an education process, not just of the council, but of the public on why we're trying to make strategic decisions that are really in the long-term best interest of our community.
There, you touched on this. There's this discussion about people wanting to live in new construction. Some people want to live in a new home, and they should have that choice. But does new construction have to happen in a former cornfield on the periphery of the community?
Well, obviously, my answer to that question would be no. And if they do want to, if they want to do that, then they can incorporate and pay for their own police and fire and sewer and water and all of the services and parks. That's certainly an option. They're not going to do that because it would not be financially viable. So we need to make sure that it's financially viable, that it's good for our community.
What do you think of what former Alderman Jim Froon had to say before the meeting? He sort of cast this as a ward versus ward discussion. What do you think of what he had to say?
I have respect for Jim Froon. He's served the community for a long time. This is one thing I totally disagree with him on. This is a holistic thing. This is not ward versus ward.
This is
community-wide. In fact, quite the contrary.
How important is it to you as mayor that the spirit and the letter of the comprehensive plan is followed from here on out?
Essential. I think that's one word and it pretty much sums it up, because we had about 8,000 people participate in that comprehensive plan and has some clear guidelines with future growth that's maybe not in our downtown. That's certainly highly prized, but also compact, contiguous, so that we have walkable, sustainable cities for the future. There'll be less pollution. There'll be less traffic. All of the things. This is the 21st century city model that people are looking towards.
Development on the periphery of the community, greenfield development, is easier than infill for developers. Is there a way to refocus developers in this community to look at the opportunities that exist closer to the city core?
Absolutely. And we do this a lot. I have conversations with possible developers all the time about a variety of different sites that are currently in the city of Bloomington. We don't have to worry about an annexation agreement, and that could very easily sustain new development.
That's Mayor Terry Renner, who joins us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Aldermen met last night in a non-voting committee of the whole meeting. 5 groups are now calling for some sort of citizen-led oversight board for the Bloomington Police. Where are you on this issue?
Well, obviously, we're bringing this to the I'm with the city manager. We brought this to the council for discussion. And certainly I've talked to all of the groups many times. And we do have a great group of police officers, but we've also got people in the community that are concerned. And if, as Barack Obama, former President Obama, said in the 21st Century Task Force that he put together on policing for the future, he said, if a segment of our society feels like they are detached from law enforcement, or that they think at least they can't trust law enforcement, then everybody has a problem. And so I think this conversation was a very good one. There are limitations to what this might be. There are a lot of options that were discussed, but it would not be, let's make it clear, it would not be an oversight board. It might be a review board, an advisory board, so that you have another set of eyes. Now, given our police contracts, it might be difficult for us to figure out exactly how that might be structured. One other possibility that some support, I think most don't, though, is maybe restructuring MAP, the Minority and Police Partnership Group. There are any number of possibilities that we're going to be considering. So last night was the beginning of the conversation, and all of the aldermen, except for Alderman Dave Sage, said that they felt that they would like to at least explore this and take it to the next step. And so we're going to be doing the individual elected officials some homework on this and coming back for a second wave of discussions to kind of narrow down our choices.
A couple of follow-up questions. One about the homework assignment. But first, let's talk about Alderman Sage and what he had to say. He didn't really see a need for a review board in light of the other mechanisms for police to file a complaint with the police. He also brought up things like coffee with a cop or ice cream with a cop. Do those count as legitimate touch points to resolve complaints?
Well, I don't know about result complaints. Actually, President Obama's 21st Century Task Force on Law Enforcement does suggest more community policing and outreach like that, whether it's ice cream with a cop, coffee with a cop, walking the beat, understanding the community rather than being separate from a community. And so that part I understand, but that doesn't solve the underlying issue. As I believe Alderman Mboka of Milwaukee mentioned, that if there are some people who feel that they cannot or feel intimidated by filing any kind of complaints with the police, then we at least have a perception problem, if not a substantive problem. And so that's what we're working on. So even if the best and best of intentions, even if this is all a perception problem, and I don't think it's all a perception problem. I think it's probably mostly a perception problem. But there are, in a group of 125 police officers, you know, you're going to have a few people who go off the reservation. Now, we don't want any tragedies in Bloomington, but I can tell you most of our police officers are just very, very impressive people. And the vast majority have degrees, college degrees. They have served in the military. I think most of them take their jobs very seriously. But that doesn't mean that we can't have another set of eyes.
Our past reporting here at GLT and then the Stevenson Center study released last week indicates African Americans are treated differently by the police. At least they perceive that. Is that reason enough, do you think,
I think it's reason enough for us to have a conversation and to maybe have some extra checks in place or to try to build trust. And it's not just that. I tried to keep it at 500 feet. If you'll note, we did not say on yesterday's Committee of the Whole, it did not say Citizens Task Force. That is one piece.
It was about
piece.
Police community relations.
And how can we generally improve that? And this might be one way, you know, to make that happen. And again, the council will continue. At least there seem to be all but Alderman Sage that we're interested in continuing a conversation to take this to the next step.
And let me circle back to the homework issue. Why didn't you ask staff to do that research instead of saying the aldermen have more work to do? Wouldn't that be staff's responsibility?
It would normally. I actually started with that. Alderman Sage said, we ought to own this. And I said, okay, well, let's see what we can come up with. And if we come back and our homework is like Swiss cheese, that is lots of gaping holes in it, then we may need to turn to staff to help fill in some of that. So certainly I think we did have, actually, our attorneys from Sterling Northrop had mentioned some options that we might have in terms of models. We would just have to craft, if the council wants to go forward with this, we would have to craft it around our union contracts, and it would have to be purely advisory.
Well, let's talk about the union contract. What the issues with the union contract prevent some sort of citizen-led review board that would have teeth?
Probably. It essentially says that you can't, once a police officer has gone through an internal investigation and it has been concluded, they cannot be compelled to testify to some citizens review board. So there may be any number of ways that this could be handled.
I mean, the city negotiates the contract with the police union, so it could be on the table at the next negotiating session, correct?
It could, but I think that would do, you know, if we can construct something that is consistent with our current union contract, I think that's win-win for everybody, because we don't want it to make it seem like we're attacking our police.
Sure.
We want them to be responsible. And we also need to monitor them. And they realize that. I mean, if you've got literally going to make life and death decisions, you know that you have to have checks.
But 200 cities in America have these civilian review boards, so certainly they have found a way, these communities have found a way to
Absolutely.
Address
sure.
these concerns and work within and they, or around the union contracts.
Right. And then they do run the gamut. Now, what we're saying here is we go into this, with that's sort of a structural issue. We already have these union contracts in place. They have been for decades. But we do need to see of the many, many different options of citizen advisory boards or review boards, what kind of composition, what kind of role might one have in Bloomington that would still be consistent with our law enforcement contracts.
And what sort of board could it be that might have actual repercussions for an officer? I mean, if it's a toothless board, what's the point of doing it?
Well, I don't know that it depends on what you mean by toothless board. I think having another set of eyes that would issue us a report if somebody feels aggrieved would certainly be news.
Well, certainly these groups probably, it would be news, but these groups probably want to have some sort of say in whether the officer is reprimanded or
right.
stays on the force.
And there aren't many places anywhere that actually have that. But the other thing that I would note is that this came up last night, and I tried to, and several people tried to reiterate this, is that we are getting body cameras. Probably by the end of the year, maybe sooner.
And that's one of my, that was my next question asked, actually, is that the missing piece?
I think body cameras, what we do know is most of the empirical evidence that I see at the U.S. Conference of Mayors is body cameras right now significantly reduce the injuries of civilians and police officers. And so it certainly does change behavior. It seems to be more effective, frankly, than the institution of citizens review boards. Now, that doesn't mean one precludes the other, but at this point, you know, there's no silver bullet, bad pun, I suppose, but the thing that seems most effective in reducing civilian injuries and officer injuries are body cameras, and we're moving in that direction.
What's the timeline for moving forward on some sort of review board or for council to address this again?
Well, we talked about this in just, again, very high level. Possibly sometime in about the next month, we'll come back, and depending on whether or not council's done their homework, of course, effectively, we'll see whether or not we have one or a couple of different options. Is council still interested in that as in terms of further reflection? Can we craft it so that it's consistent with our, obviously, the contract? So if we met and talked about it again in a month, then it could conceivably be as soon as a couple weeks after that that we actually act on a specific proposal.
Okay, Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thank you so much, Mike.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal are regular guests on Sound Ideas and join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening meetings. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, helping individuals stay healthy and active in retirement through a variety of social and well-being activities. Wellness programs and on-site therapy services available. 2025 East Lincoln Street in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Police body cam pilot projects are on the street in Bloomington Normal. During Sound Ideas last week, you heard about progress in Normal. Bloomington Police have a pilot project underway as well. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Police Chief Brendan Hefner and Sergeant Clayton Arnold. Arnold says after some months of experience with 12 cameras, the department is starting to get some takeaways.
So far, it's been a mixed bag. I think that you have a combination of the officers, even those who might be the most resistant to the idea of an introduction just because it's a foreign thing to them, have seen the value that it can produce. You know, it produces great evidence. And then there's always the idea that someone may make some allegation against you and they feel safe in the idea that it can potentially exonerate any false allegation. But I would say that the particular product that we're using right now has had some shortcomings, technologically speaking, that has limited their 100% embracing. There's a little bit of holdout because of some of the bumps in the road that we've met along the way. So we hope to overcome those. Some of those are procedural and some of those are just the camera itself. And
Chief Hefner, because of the dash cams, has there been less of an acceptance hurdle this time around than initially, perhaps?
I would say so. But like I said, the difference between the dash cams and the body camera, the dash cam doesn't go to lunch with you. The dash cam doesn't go to the restroom with you. So these are things I don't think people really, really take in consideration and understand, especially since the law has that prior to you turning it on, it's always on and recording 30-second laps. So, you know, those are just some issues that we have to overcome, but the officers, I think, in the greater scheme of things, can see the benefit because the dash cams have been very beneficial.
Sergeant Arnold, you mentioned procedural kerfuffles. What are some of those that are in the learning curve on your pilot project so far?
So I think right now what we're trying to figure out and learn is what's the impact on the amount of time you spend writing reports. We have to consult with the state's attorney. You know, you have audiovisual recording of whatever you're taking a police report on. Is it sufficient to include less content in the report just because there is that video and you don't want to spend time replicating information that's already existing elsewhere? Or does your report need to be equally detailed or more detailed? And what the state's attorney has said early on is they don't want to see any less detail than they have before. And officers that have a recording of whatever event are, especially if an arrest is made or potentially going to be made, they obviously want to make sure that they go back and really lay out in detail exactly what transpired on video and not leave it in a way that would appear that they're contradicting things, because a camera doesn't catch everything. It's one view of events, and not everything that we would like to be captured on video is going to be. So you're always going to have to lay some foundation of the sequence of events. Maybe it starts with the call for service being dispatched out in the first place. You know, that's often not captured on the video. You know, you arrive at a call for service with a certain expectation of what's going to happen just based on how it's dispatched out to you. And things that you might observe that are not captured on video. So that's one of the things. The amount of hours you can spend now writing report could go up exponentially just because you have, you know, if you have an hour-long call for service, you could sit down, review for an hour, and then take notes along the way, whereas that wasn't always the case. You hit the most critical points of your incident, and that was it.
Do you also have to contextualize the video by saying, at this point in the video, you know, this is going on, but off camera there was X, Y, and Z? Is that something that officers now are able to do more or should do more of?
Well, I think maybe to answer your question best, I can relate to one of the points that we've put out in training, is that in a sense, you're almost producing a movie when you arrive for a call for service, and you need to inform the viewer of what's going on. So we've encouraged, whenever practical, to narrate what you're seeing. Make sure that, for example, if you were to walk through a crime scene, and you were to see something that might not be visible plainly on video or would be easily dismissed as a casual viewer to watch it, make sure you highlight those things, point it out, narrate what you're seeing. So
during the time that you're recording.
Sure, yeah, because those things to the viewer, oh, I understand now why that was important to the call for service at the time. Without doing that, you know, you might have a report that doesn't necessarily reflect what a viewer is going to interpret when they see the audiovisual recording.
So is that going to cause more investment of officer time, but a whole lot less in prosecutor time, Chief?
We would hope. We would hope. And as he says, you know, you have to be very detailed. I think another point that I would add on to what Sergeant Arnold said is that the camera has one view, but in your report, your eyes may be somewhere else. And you may take some action, and the camera would only catch, you know, that in progress, as opposed to what you first saw. Like if somebody took off running, or you saw somebody throw something, you'd look to your left, and you saw somebody throw some drugs or something and run, and then you turn to go after them. All the camera's going to see is you turning and somebody running.
So the jury is going to want to know that context.
Yes, and they do. And there's going to be a learning curve, without a doubt. But as he said, that's what we're instructing officers to do. You kind of narrate people through it, you know, when you look in places and do things. And, you know, I've heard some, you know, we've had some technological issues, but I've also heard of officers requesting an officer with a body-worn camera to come to an area so they can see things, so they can capture things, be it whatever else is going on there. They can have some footage of that. So always learning.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Heffner and with Sergeant Clayton Arnold about the body camera pilot project that the Bloomington Police Department has underway. Chief Rick Bleichner of the town of Normal has said that in some cases it's actually saving time on calls. That, say, in a domestic incident, once you inform a person that they are being recorded, that it tends to settle the situation faster and that they can deal with it faster than had been the case before. Are you noticing that, or other pluses or minuses on the time on a call?
I think it would be anecdotal evidence for us at this point. I don't have any hard and fast evidence to say that that's the case or not the case. I can tell you that that's one of the things we kind of anticipate, that people's attitudes might change. You know, just once you know, we're very overt about the idea that you're being recorded. You know, I think the law says you'll be recorded. You'll make notification that you're being recorded anytime there's an expectation of privacy. Well, our internal policy says it doesn't matter whether there's an expectation or not. You're just going to give notice. So that's one of the side effects that we hope that it has, is that as people's behavior starts to escalate into a little bit more violent situation, then, you know, the notice that you're on a recording is going to bring them back down.
Tamp that down.
Sure. So, in that essence, I suppose if we are able to mitigate some opportunity for violence, then yes, we're going to save time, because it takes a lot of paperwork and a lot of time to use force and then document it appropriately. And heaven forbid anybody get injured, that takes even more time. So there is potential some cost savings there in terms of time. But I don't have hard and fast evidence. It'd be anecdotal to say that's probably happening on some level.
In the pilot project, are you collecting useful footage for officer review and feedback and coaching and training?
Yes. There's always been a component of the law that allows us to review things for, you know, internal review, right? And we expect that as officers encounter something that is particularly of good use to other officers. Maybe it's an officer safety concern, or maybe it's somebody that isn't necessarily a safety concern, but is someone who has a mental health issue, where other officers need to be aware when they encounter this person, they may see some strange behavior that they could more quickly diagnose as being the result of mental health issues versus just someone on drugs or something else. The sharing of knowledge in that way can absolutely benefit the whole of the department and maybe make us a little more efficient and avoid some problems. You can't say that that's going to happen every time, because, you know, it would be useful for everyone to see everybody's video all the time to be more informed. You have to kind of pick and choose those opportunities. Maybe it's a house where you've encountered some violence and the layout of the house is, it wouldn't be the first time that we've had to go back and serve a warrant on a home that where a lot of violence has happened, and you might anticipate the encountering of violence and say, well, here's the layout of the home and where you might expect to run into people and keep everybody safer that way. So there's a lot of stuff that you could use those for that is maybe training related or just officer safety related.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the Bloomington Police Department body cam pilot project with Sergeant Clayton Arnold and with Chief Brendan Heffner. You've indicated so far that you haven't gotten the best performance out of the tool that you're evaluating. What are the deficiencies, and what do you need them to do to get the contract?
I would say centrally the number one thing that we've been disappointed in is the battery life, and the vendor that we use currently has acknowledged that that might be an issue for us, and they're working on the next generation product, which should be available shortly, and they say that it's solved that problem. We've had a few network communication errors, which some firmware upgrades have broken communication, which they were ultimately resolved, but there was some lag in the time that it happened to the time we got it fixed. And then, for example, personalized settings. So if I give this camera to Officer A, usually all their personal information is embedded as metadata inside of every recording, right? There's been occasions where those cameras have, for whatever reason, just completely forgotten all of that metadata, and we've had to go back and have our IT department reprogram the cameras. So those are just a few things that they're annoyances, but there's also been a couple of times when the camera flat out got, well, I'll use one example specifically. An officer was in the middle of using force in the course of trying to make an arrest. The camera got knocked off in the fight, hit the ground pretty hard, and the recording was gone. It evaporated. We think that maybe we're speculating, but we assume that the power got jostled, and in the course of recording the video, it was just gone. And to the officer who's using force, that's a pretty gut-wrenching moment when you think this is precisely what these things are designed to do, is capture those moments to make sure that those who would view it would see exactly why I needed to use it. And you don't want anyone to come out and say, the only reason it's not there is because you turned it off, which you're never going to placate everybody. But at the same time, it was kind of disheartening to have that occur. The good thing for us is in that case, what we were able to show was a table date and time entry of a recording started. We showed that a recording was started at that time. It just didn't point to an existing file. So we corroborated the fact that he did start a recording. It just didn't exist. But, you know, you can't say for 100% fact you'll always be able to do that. You know, technology fails. It's just the way it is. Even our best cell phones in the world sometimes don't get a signal. You know, so.
Yeah. Dropped call. Yeah. What is the battery life and what do you need it to be?
The law mandates 10 hours of recording, but they don't specify if that means 10 hours of capacity on the SD card inside the camera or if that is battery life. We would assume that that's battery life. That's our interpretation of it, because most shifts are 8 hours long, with the rare occasion 10 or 12 hours long. So 10 hours of battery life is kind of how we've viewed what the statutory requirement has set the bar at.
And what are you getting?
It depends on the officer and the amount of use in a given day, whether or not they leave some of the features turned on. For example, they have the ability to upload wirelessly or hardwired. Each feature that you leave on throughout your shift tends to cut into the battery life. But I've seen officers report back as little as 3 or 4 hours.
Oops.
And then other officers who are extraordinarily diligent about plugging in their camera at every given opportunity, they might get through a full shift most of the time. Now, I'll tell you that one of the nice things about the cameras that we're currently using is they have a almost like a Apple-type MagSafe adapter connection at the bottom. So let's say you could plug in your car, it'll magnetically attach to your camera. You could get out of the car quickly, and it won't damage the camera when it pulls away. So in that sense, it's really nice. But the other thing that the officers have found is it's not a super strong magnet, and so when you put your seatbelt on, sometimes it jars that loose, and you think you're getting a charge, and you don't. So just another one of those things we've run into as we've experienced the cameras a little bit longer, something that might be improved in future revisions.
So Bloomington is not a late adopter of this system, but it certainly isn't an early adopter. You would think that the companies, the vendors, would have established a suitable battery life already for sale. Why not?
I just think it's just like your cell phone. They advertise you can get so many hours, but it really just depends on how much you download, how much you're on the internet. So I think this next iteration that we're supposed to be getting, like they advertised 10 hours on this one. The next one is supposed to be 12, I believe. So probably with 12, we will probably get to the 10 that we are supposed to have.
Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner and Sergeant Clayton Arnold talking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Police say if the next generation of cameras works well, the department may roll them out to all officers early next year. If the camera doesn't perform, they'll have to wait and see. Chief Hefner says there are a lot of horror stories about departments that ran out, got cameras, and they turned out to be duds or didn't perform as advertised. He says one of the most important features they want is automatic camera activation when the indoor car lights come on. Hefner says if the officer has to get out of the car in a hurry, he or she shouldn't have to mess with a switch on their chest. Another must is a speedy download time to department servers.
to prevent lost officer time. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Recently, defense attorney and author James Duane spoke at Illinois State University. His YouTube video suggesting people not talk to the police, even if someone is on the periphery of a case, has 2.6 million views. From a prosecutor point of view, it's important for people to talk with the police. GLT's Charlie Schlenker spoke with McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers about his reaction to that line of thinking.
And I think it's important to differentiate between the idea of if you're a suspect talking to police or you're a bystander or a witness talking to police. If you're a suspect in a case, that's a different scenario. And by all means, even as a prosecutor, when somebody contacts me who's a suspect, in a case that maybe we're screening, my response to them is, you need to go consult with an attorney. If you want to have them present and talk to me, that's fine. But that's the avenue that they need to go. When people start saying that bystanders or witnesses should not reach out to the police, that becomes a little bit more concerning for me. And I'm not saying necessarily from a prosecutorial standpoint. I'm saying from a public safety standpoint. The idea that was put out there was the only time you should ever talk to police, I think, what was said was during a traffic stop. I mean, that implies everything else someone shouldn't. So if you see a crime occur, that position was don't call the police. Don't tell them what's happening. From a public safety standpoint, I don't think that's the right way that we want to be going as a community. Things are not a zero-sum game where everything should be I'm going to look out for myself and no one else.
How does it affect the idea of community?
Right. I mean, if it's something where it's I'm just focusing on me and no one else, well, then there is no community at that point, right? If you say someone else will take care of that, someone else will address that problem, that's one of those things that maybe in any one individual circumstance works well for that person, but long term it's not going to work well for that person, because then what society are they going to live in? And we see that not just in the criminal justice system, we see it in everything. Well, not everything. We see it in lots of things. For example, if somebody said, I'm not going to give to GLT this time around because, hey, someone else will do it. Maybe that works for you this time. But what happens 5 or 6 years down the road when lots of people start doing that and there's no more GLT because of that? It's not something where we can say, you know, in every single circumstance, what's good for me right now? People need to be saying, what's good for my community? What's good for public safety as a whole?
Or taxes in general.
Taxes, right.
From your contacts with the public, how prevalent is this attitude of that speaker, and how alive and well is the idea of community in our area?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, we have a lot of people who come forward in cases and talk to the police because they understand it's a truth-seeking endeavor that we're doing when we're going through the court system. So I do think it's important to note that there's two different sides to this. There's the public safety aspect of something's happening right now, someone needs to contact the police. And then there's also the, let's say you saw something that happened and you didn't do that, but it's 3 or 4 days later, there's still merit in contacting the police and letting them know what it is that happened. Because once it's in the system, we want to get to the truth. We want to know what happened. I have no interest in prosecuting somebody who I think didn't do it. And we've even had that happen with cases. I've had circumstances where I had one about sometime early last fall, one of my prosecutors came in my office and he said, I just want to let you know, I had to dismiss a case today. And I've given them considerable discretion in these circumstances. And I want a heads up, but he said, I had to dismiss a case today because I talked with a witness and he made some statements that I really wasn't comfortable with that didn't fit with what we thought the facts of the case were at the time. And I wasn't comfortable putting them on the stand based on that. And because of that, without that witness, we weren't going to be able to go forward. And he dismissed it. And that was the right thing. That was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to let me know afterwards, just so I had a heads up on it. But our position isn't go forward no matter what. And if somebody knows information about an incident which might affect the way that we would go forward with it, we'd like to know. We want to try to get to the truth.
If the idea of community is fairly robust, is there a danger that people will conflate over time, this attitude about the prosecutorial side of things and about maybe there are tensions with police in a certain area or with a certain demographic group, and erode that idea of community by not reporting because the matters are tense with, say, on the west side between police and neighbors, or that they're hearing this message from guys like this lawyer who came to ISU to give his speech about don't talk to the police, and that the idea of community will erode, or the idea of cooperation with relevant authorities is going to be less robust than it used to be.
I have a hard time picturing a situation where more communication and more cooperation makes us a weaker community. I think it's something where I understand why there are circumstances where there's distrust, and there might be individuals who have had a circumstance that has warranted them feeling distrustful. But as a whole, I don't think that's gonna lead to that. I think the more people are involved, the more people who can help us get to the truth, then the more confidence there is in the process at the end.
McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Get your summer started with a dose of the blues. CEFQ presents the GLT Summer Concert featuring Thornetta Davis, Detroit's Queen of the Blues. Get up, get up, get up and dance away your blues. Also on stage, it's Los Tex-Maniacs and Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. It's the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, in Museum Square in downtown Bloomington. The music starts at 5, and it's free. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at JustinMBoyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Americans are burdened with more student debt load than ever before, over $1.4 trillion spread out over 44 million borrowers. The average student who just graduated did so with over $37,000 in debt. One local group aims to help students by relieving some financial pressures. Laura Kennedy has more.
The annual gala at the galleries is more than simply a celebration of the arts. The fundraising event allows the community to support rising artists like Dylan Welch and help offset the rising costs of education. The event is Saturday night at the University Galleries and is organized by the Friends of the Arts, which member Brian Honker describes as a fundraising organization that not only offers scholarships, but it also provides grants to fine arts students at Illinois State University to help them fund their creative projects.
Every year we were rolling out scholarships to help the students get to the university, but we saw once they got here just the rising cost of materials, music sheets, scripts, just the various things that the art students need, increasing from year to year to year. And in order for the students to actually finish up their projects, they needed some extra income. Mm-hmm. So we stepped in to help that, as well as the process that they go through in obtaining a grant from us. If they're going to choose to go out in the professional world to pursue a profession in the arts, grant writing is kind of a staple of what they're going to have to do. So by working with us and working towards a grant from us, they're actually learning how to write those grants in the future.
And Dylan, you are a student here. You are focusing on printmaking.
Correct, yeah.
You're a two-time recipient of the grants. And so did you actually write the grants yourself?
I did, yeah.
So tell me how the grant has changed your life as an art student.
Yeah, it's very expensive to be an arts student. Materials get really, really expensive. So as you're planning a project, you know, you can start to feel like things are kind of closing in on you and you can't kind of dream quite as big. And so when you have just a little extra money, then it really opens the door to have bigger ideas. And
let's hear about those bigger ideas that you've had. I think it's distressing. I think it would be distressing to anyone to hear that an artist wouldn't be able to dream as big because they didn't have the funds in order to create their vision. So tell me about what you have been able to create thanks to the grant.
Yeah, well, my first project was a papermaking project, and I kind of got here and was trying to get involved with the community and get involved with the Horticulture Center a little bit too, because I thought that there was some really great possibilities there. So I applied for a grant to run a kind of community papermaking workshop and have a little garden with some papermaking plants.
Like what?
Well, some agave. We had some cozo and what else do we have? Papyrus. For a very ancient kind of papermaking. So that was really fun for me, and I got to work with Jessica over at the Horticulture Center. So it was actually really great for me because that was my second semester here. So I really got to get involved and had this kind of reason to get involved, and you know, the Friends of the Arts really supported that.
So you've really benefited. Your art has really benefited from the grants that you had. And basically, do you feel like you wouldn't have made the same progress without it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other grant I received was to help with my thesis work. And so that's really a time when you don't want to be constrained by, you know, financial issues. And so that really allowed me to get the right materials to work bigger, and I ended up working quite a bit bigger than I might have otherwise. And just have, you know, even just small things like printing nicer announcement cards. And that, like, makes a big difference just to have a nice quality for that kind of thing.
So you're graduating without quite as much student debt thanks to the grants
indeed,
that you had.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and a good feather in my cap just feeling having received a couple grants and can put that on my CV.
You are an artist yourself, and you've gone to work in business. What does it mean to you to be in a position now where you can help up-and-coming artists in the academic world? You're able to help them get these grants. What does that mean to you?
That they don't have to come out of school with as much credit card debt as I had. It really is. You know, I spent 4 years back in the art department and graduated many years ago. But the skills I learned there, I would value far more than any of the other ones I've learned throughout even my college experience and since then, because it's the critical thinking, being able to analyze your work, being able to put your work up on the wall and listen to the good criticism come out of all these other students, but being able to not be upset by that criticism, but to turn around and take that and refine your work has been huge. Giving back to the students now, it really just allows me to just still be part of the community and to help those students learn easier and more, you know, so that they can learn more than I ever learned and take those out into the field and continue to pursue what they really care about.
Well, let's focus on the event itself. Is there an auction involved? Are you auctioning off the artwork of the students?
Not necessarily the students, but we have quite a bit of artwork from the alumni from the university as well as the larger art community. We also have experiences that couple of the local businesses have put in.
Experiences, that sounds so mysterious.
Mm. Well, the one I'm a fan of that I try to bid on every year and have lost so far every year. One of the theater professors actually is donating his time to teach swordplay. So you can actually bid on an item. And
that would be Paul Denhart, I'll bet.
Yeah. You know, so it's just not art for the wall. It's things you can experience, you know, chocolate for a month. One of the local shops in downtown Bloomington is donating a summer camp where kids can come and play various board games. So we have all kinds of experiences out there, art from the local community and the broader community at large.
Will the students be there as well? Dylan, will you be there as well, basically giving feedback to the people so they know what they're supporting?
Yeah, absolutely. I will be there. I have a piece in there, too. A bunch of graduate students, some really beautiful
What's your piece?
In there. Mine is an etching with some hand drawing on it, so real traditional printmaking technique. It's just really nice to feel. I remember my kind of first and second semester, and I was just getting, you know, accustomed to being here. I felt very supported by the Friends of the Arts, and I received that grant my second semester and met some people from the board, and it just felt very welcoming and like people in the community telling us that they support our work. So when I received the papermaking grant, I got to work with Lisa Lofgren, who's a local artist and runs a community print shop, and that was one of my first experiences working with her, and then I kind of got to know her a little better and spent some time at Come Together Space, which is her print shop and kind of community center space. And it turns out that my husband and I got married there in about a year. So I was thinking, like, wow, the Friends of the Arts kind of
They kind of were like the matchmaker rolling there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
and your husband's an artist as well.
Yes, he is. He's in the visual culture program, and he just received a grant along with his name is Greg Solo, and his kind of co-conspirator on this project is Ryan Peluchek, and they're working on a bunch of speakers that they just built, and they're having a sound performance.
So the grants are kind of running in the family,
they
as it were.
They are running in the family, indeed. Yeah, and we're really grateful.
That's artist Dylan Welch and Friends of the Arts member Brian Honker. The gala at the galleries is Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. Tickets are available online. I'm Laura Kennedy.
And there's still more support for students who value the arts. Nicki Minaj has made education a priority with her charitable efforts. Just this past Saturday, the rapper and singer posted on Instagram that she's paying more than tens of thousands of dollars to students who can verify straight A's, and she's helping to pay for books and tuition. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal with help today from Charlie Schlenker and Laura Kennedy. Also thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for his time today. You can find all of the stories and the complete podcast at WGLT.org. We also want to know what you think of this show. Post your comments to Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. And WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.